From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some of the paradoxes of life in Iran today. A modern theocracy where a woman can't shake hands with a man, yet there are unisex bathrooms. We talk with Elaine Shalino of the New York Times. Over the past 20 years, she's reported on many key events in Iran, from the revolution in 1979 to the student protests of 1999. We'll also discuss the current leadership in Iran and its position on the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. Also, we talk about the World Series with baseball historian Jules Tigel, and Maureen Corrigan reviews the complete collection of short stories by the late satirical writer Evelyn Waugh. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. George W. Bush is campaigning today in Florida, touring the central part of the state with his brother, Florida Governor Jeb Bush, and his former presidential rival, Senator John McCain. The Republican nominee is focusing on his plans for Social Security in an effort to reassure senior citizens that he'll protect the retirement program for them while keeping it intact for young workers. Florida is a key state in which Bush and his Democratic rival have been rated as close in the polls. The State Department says the public was informed about a 1995 agreement between Vice President Gore and then Russian Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin. Republicans charged that the agreement allowed Russia to sell weapons to Iran. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Republicans on the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee allege Gore signed a secret deal with Chernomyrdin, and the administration then looked the other way as Russia sold sophisticated weapons, including tanks and submarines, to Iran. Such sales would be in violation of a 1992 law prohibiting arms sales to nations viewed as exporters of terrorism. Republican Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas said the administration played word games to avoid the law.
The Gore-Chernomyrdin deal is a, quote, understanding, and not a, quote, agreement. Now, this kind of legal hair splitting causes the American people to question the honesty and integrity of their elected officials.
But State Department officials said the Gore-Chernomyrdin arrangement was announced publicly. Democrats said the hearing was aimed at putting Gore in a bad light less than 2 weeks before Election Day. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Government scientists are simulating deadly gas attacks on the streets of Salt Lake City this week. And the tests show how chemical or biological agents might behave when released in urban areas. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
The Energy and Defense Departments are conducting the gas experiments. Scientists are hoping to learn how deadly gases might travel and disperse, including how gas might infiltrate ventilation systems in office buildings. They're releasing on street corners a harmless simulant and tracking it with portable weather stations. They chose Salt Lake City, they say, because it's in a basin surrounded by mountains and experiences weather inversions that trap foul air. That makes a biological or chemical attack even more dangerous. Salt Lake City is also hosting the 2002 Winter Olympics, making it a potential target for terrorists. Word of the experiment has prompted some worried calls to police. The region has suffered from nuclear weapons and chemical warfare testing in the past, but officials say this experiment is harmless. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 67 points to close at 10,326 in active trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 190 points, or 5.5%. It closed at 3230. This is NPR News. The Russian Navy says a team of Norwegian and Russian divers have found three bodies inside the nuclear sub that sank in the Arctic last August. After 5 days of effort, the divers succeeded in cutting a hole through the hull of the Kursk. Russian officials say they expect to recover only about a third of the 118 sailors who died on the sub, saying that most of the bodies were probably destroyed by the powerful explosions that sank the vessel. Confessions continue at the trial in the Tour de France doping scandal. The last Festina cycling team members, who claimed to be substance-free, have admitted they also took performance-enhancing drugs. Sarah Chase reports from Paris.
More and more people are wondering why the International Cycling Union and the French Federation aren't defendants at this trial. The presiding judge has set it up to shed light not only on whether the nine defendants encourage cycle racers to use performance-enhancing drugs, but also on the doping system throughout professional racing. Today's confessions were illuminating. Laurent Brochard admitted there were still drugs in his system when he won the 1997 World Championships. He tested positive, but then produced a doctor's prescription that covered the results. On the stand today, he testified that the International Union and the French Federation told him to obtain a backdated prescription. The two organizations are civil parties to the case. In other words, they're presenting themselves as victims of the scandal. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Paris.
Emergency officials in the Central Asian Republic of Georgia say they found no survivors in the wreckage of a Russian military plane that crashed into a mountain near the Black Sea. Officials said the plane had 75 people aboard. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Elaine Shalino first arrived in Iran at one of the most dramatic moments in the country's recent life. She was on the plane with Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979 as he flew from Paris, where he'd been living in exile, to Iran, where he assumed leadership of the revolutionary government. Shalino was a foreign correspondent for Newsweek at the time. After covering the Iranian Revolution, she continued to report from Iran on and off for the next 20 years. In her new book, Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran, she writes about the contradictions of daily life in the world's only modern theocracy, a country combining elements of democracy with Islam. She's a senior writer at the Washington Bureau of the New York Times and has also served as the paper's chief diplomatic correspondent, intelligence correspondent, and UN bureau chief. I asked Elaine Shalino about the connection between Iran and the current conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians.
Iran still plays a big role in the Middle East conflict, even though geographically it's very distant. You know, one of the initial goals of Iran's revolution, of Ayatollah Khomeini when he came to power, was the exportation of revolution around the entire Muslim world. This plan failed miserably, except to a certain extent in Lebanon, where Iran still has a playing field. Iran still provides material support and weapons to Hezbollah, and material support and perhaps weapons to the Palestinian rejectionist groups, and is still interested in sabotaging or at least preventing any kind of settlement of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
So do you think that this new conflict opens the door for Iran to become even more active in trying to prevent any further peace process?
Well, it's a tricky question, Terry, because since Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon, the landscape has changed. And even though Iran has turned up the volume rhetorically, there is no evidence, at least in terms of what U.S. intelligence can see, that it has increased its weapon supplies or its material support. So this is very much a policy and a process in flux that American intelligence agencies are watching very carefully to see whether this stepped-up rhetoric is matched by increased support.
How has the rhetoric been stepped up? What are Iran's leaders saying about Israel and the Palestinians?
There have been statements by some Iranian clerics that there should be a holy war and that there should be some kind of real material support. But, we should keep in mind that Iran's spiritual leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who wields more power than the elected president, has called Yasser Arafat a simpleton and a traitor. You know, there is no love between Iran's Shiite Ayatollahs and the PLO. So this complicates matters because on the one hand, Iran, would like to see, Israel neutralized or weakened. But on the other hand, Arafat is not widely respected. The spiritual leader has said so. And Iran's president, the elected president, Khatami, has said that any settlement that would be acceptable to the Palestinians would be acceptable to Iran.
Why is Arafat looked down on by these Iranian leaders? Is it because he's participating in the peace process, or is it for other reasons?
It's in part because he's participating in the peace process, but you know, Arafat was never regarded as a leading figure of the Islamic world. And right from the beginning, there was suspicion of Arafat. And even though there were always embraces between Ayatollah Khomeini and Arafat, there's never been a close relationship.
Let's talk about the current leadership in Iran before we move on to some of your experiences reporting from the country. The current president, Mohammad Khatami, you describe him as a reformer. In what ways has he been a reformer?
Well, this is a guy who came from nowhere. For 5 years, he was the head of Iran's National Library, and he certainly wasn't a figure on Iran's political scene. He wasn't supposed to win the election in 1997. Another cleric who was the darling of the clerical establishment was supposed to, and Khatami was sort of allowed into the race because, you know, he wore the turban of a cleric and he was one of them. But surprise, surprise, he ran on a platform of tolerance, of creating the rule of law, and creating a civil society for Iran. He appealed to Iran's women. He appealed to Iran's youth. You know, young people make up 65% of the population. 65% of the population is under the age of 25. And he won with an enormous mandate. And the mandate was one of change.
At the same time, though, there's the Ayatollah Khamenei, not to be confused with Ayatollah Khomeini.
I know. They all start with K. It's really quite confusing.
And he's not a reformer at all from what I've read. So is the Ayatollah at odds with the president?
They have an interesting relationship of cohabitation. They need each other. They're both clerics. They both believe in the Islamic Republic, but they have very different worldviews. But they can't live without each other. Khamenei knows that Khatami, the president, has the mandate of the people, and Khatami knows that Khamenei has the constitution behind him. It's an interesting kind of guerrilla battle that's going on in Iranian politics today.
Are Iranian-U.S. relations warming any, and is the Palestinian-Israeli crisis affecting the possible warming of relations?
Iranian-U.S. relations have warmed very little in the last year or so. The Clinton administration has made a concerted effort to try to change the rhetoric, tone down the rhetoric. Iran technically is no longer an international outlaw. It's no longer a rogue state. It's what they call a state of concern. There has been a minor lifting of some of the peripheral sanctions, economic sanctions on both sides. But Clinton's running out of time, and he can't take any bold gestures between now and the end of his time in office because the Iranians haven't done themselves any favors. The closure of the newspapers, a ruling by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, that banned parliament, an elected parliament, from considering a controversial press law, was an anti-democratic act. And the trial of the Jews in Shiraz some time ago together just send a chilling effect, have a chilling effect on the administration. In terms of the Israeli and Palestinian conflict, the fact that the Iranian foreign minister was in Lebanon, was in Syria, underscoring Iran's support for Hezbollah and the Palestinian rejectionist groups, it doesn't help matters. So I'm not very optimistic that we're going to see a change in the short run.
My guest is Elaine Shalino of the New York Times. Her new book, Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran, is based on the approximately 20 years she spent reporting from Iran. As you've said, there's a bulge in the population in Iran of people under 25. 65% of the population is under 25. So those people didn't grow up with the revolution. They don't remember the Shah. What do they want that they don't have, the young people in Iran?
Well, you make a very, very critical point, which is these young people, they don't know the Shah. They don't know Ayatollah Khomeini. They don't know the sacrifices of the 8-year war with Iraq. But they do know the internet, and many of them know satellite television. Even though it's illegal, many people have satellite dishes and you can watch CNN or the BBC or Monday Night Football. There's even a lively illegal satellite dish producing industry in Iran. It used to be the internet was very, very expensive. Now it's getting much more accessible because you no longer have to make a long distance call to log on to the internet. So as society changes and as information about the rest of the world becomes more immediate, young people's wants change. You know, young people want to go to university. At the moment, only 1 out of 10 Iranians who apply to university can get in. They want jobs. There is such a huge influx into the labor force every year that Iran needs to create hundreds of thousands of jobs, which it just can't create given its economic problems. They want to be able to get married. They want to have enough money to set up a household. And, you know, they want more freedom. They just want the right to be, in a way, on the streets so that they're not hassled or harassed by morals police who come down on them from time to time.
What's behind this baby boom in Iran, this 65% of the population being under 25?
Well, early in the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini announced that those who made the revolution should breed and should create a generation of warriors for Islam. You know, this was part of the whole battle and whole campaign to export Iranian revolution throughout the entire Islamic world. Well, it backfired, and by about 1987, Iran had one of the largest population rates in the entire world. And so the policy was quickly changed so that it not only became okay to use birth control, but it became preferable to use birth control. And now one can get a free vasectomy in Tehran. There are huge billboards advertising vasectomies. Young people have to go to birth control training classes before they can get married, sort of like what Catholics do with pre-Cana. There are penalties for having too many children.
My guest is Elaine Shalino of the New York Times. Her new book is called Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elaine Shalino of the New York Times. She's the author of the new book, Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran. And it's based on her 20 years of traveling to and reporting from Iran. What are some of the rights women don't have in Iran that they seem to want most?
I've got to answer that question first by saying what rights women in Iran do have, because they have a lot of rights that women in other parts of the Muslim world in the Middle East don't have. They work, they vote, they run for office, they run their own businesses, they go to university. They're lawyers, they're prostitutes, they're teachers. But there is a very strict penal code that is anti-women, frankly. A woman's testimony in court is only worth half of a man's. A woman can only inherit half of what a man can. A woman has a very difficult time divorcing her husband if her husband opposes the divorce, unless she can prove in a public court such crimes as impotence or mental illness or drug addiction. The husband always gets custody of the children when the children reach a certain age. And it's interesting, one of the things that war widows did during the war with Iraq is they pushed through Parliament a bill that allowed them to get the children, their children back when their husbands were killed in the war, and the children didn't automatically go to their husbands' families.
Well, getting back to rights women don't have that they seem to want most, what have you learned about that?
Well, women also want the right to wear what they want on the street. It sounds like a trivial thing, but when it's 100 degrees and you've got to wear a scarf on your head and a long robe, whether you're 90 years old or you're 12 years old, it can be a bit oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
Even the most religious women who wear the full black chador that they would hold under their chin to keep it secure, want the right to walk on the street without a strange man having the ability to come up to them and tell them that their head covering or their body covering isn't quite enough. You know, it's very simple, basic rights. You know, women can go to university, so they have won that battle. But yet, whether you're a man or a woman, if you don't pass a morality test as well as an academic test, you don't get in.
You know, there's a photograph in your book of women at a cosmetic shop in Tehran.
Yes.
And they're all wearing, you know, like black headdresses and black robes, trying on lipstick. And the person selling it to them is also wearing, you know, a long black robe and a black headdress. And you look at this picture and you wonder, how does the lipstick match?
How does it compute?
Yeah, how does that compute? When where do the women wear the lipstick?
Makeup is basically acceptable now, at least in certain parts of certain cities. Again, this is it's an episodic kind of experiment, and the streets is one of the battlefields. So you will see women made up like clowns because it's semi-forbidden. So you always want to do what's forbidden. But at home, women certainly can wear makeup. You know, I've interviewed the mother of President Hatemi, and she was wearing enormous amounts of eyeliner and a lot of foundation and blush and even a little bit of lipstick. In fact, the president got furious with her his mother for talking to me about, you know, the question of beauty and just how important it was for Iranian women to look beautiful.
I think a couple of Iranian movies have recently won in the past couple of years won big awards at a couple of the
yes.
film festivals.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about this, you know, what's happening in the Iranian film industry now.
The Iranian film industry is one of the guerrilla battlefields where you've got an explosion of creativity and really where filmmakers are testing the limits of the system. What one sees on the screen is all sorts of ordinary problems of Iranians. Their tragedies, their dilemmas, issues that they might not even talk about in their living rooms are on the screen. Issues like suicide, polygamy, unemployment, the lack of places for young people at university, divorce, spousal abuse, child abuse, murder, you know, all of these, drug addiction, all of these issues are there for everybody to see. And what it is, to a certain extent, is testing the limits. There are films that are screened for just once or maybe for 2 weeks to kind of see whether or not they'll pass the censors. There are films that might be edited for internal consumption but might be shipped out differently for foreign consumption. It's in the interest of the Iranian government to portray Iran as a human country. And I think that all of the attention and acclaim that has been paid to Iranian films has helped improve the image of Iran. This is happening despite the fact that many Iranian films capture the dark side of Iranian society.
Your new book, Persian Mirrors, is based on the 20 years that you've spent reporting from Iran. Not all those 20 years, but you've been back and forth there many times and reported there from there off and on for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Your first trip there, I believe, was when you traveled there with the Ayatollah Khomeini
yes.
at the time of the Iranian Revolution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How did you get to be on the plane with him?
I'm not an Iran expert. I was never an Iran expert by training. I studied the French Revolution in 18th century France in graduate school, and that's why I was a correspondent in France for Newsweek magazine. And I was the junior person in a bureau with four other people. And so when I volunteered to go out and cover an obscure cleric who had just landed outside of Paris, there were no objections from the senior members of the Bureau and Newsweek. And when it came time to put someone on that plane, you know, I went on that plane with more than 100 other journalists. And Khomeini knew it was a dangerous trip. He banned all Iranian women from going on the plane. In fact, the plane carried enough fuel that in case there was any difficulty on the ground, that we could have turned around and gone to Paris. And later I discovered, much later in researching the book, that there actually was a plan by the head of the Iranian Air Force to blow up the plane that was presented to President Carter.
Wow. Did you feel apprehensive on this plane?
I was young and foolish and single. In retrospect, I suppose I could have said I wouldn't have gone on the plane, but it didn't occur to me at the time. Although when we were circling Tehran's international airport for the third time and I could see a sea of the Shah's troops on the tarmac, I did pause for a minute and wonder if this had been a wise thing to do.
What happened when you landed?
Well, there were more than a million people on the streets of Tehran that day, greeting the Ayatollah. And I remember driving into Tehran, there was a sign in four languages that said, "Welcome to the journalists covering the Ayatollah." And we were welcomed with the sweets and kisses because we had helped bring the Ayatollah into the country. The revolution happened, and it was a very dangerous time, a time when all of the weapons that had been in the Shah's arsenals were liberated, quote-unquote liberated, and young people were driving around with weapons much too big for them and that they didn't know how to use on the streets, and using them. There were executions of the Shah's generals, and a revolution was made.
Did you expect that the Ayatollah Khomeini would be as strict a fundamentalist ruler and as dogmatic as he turned out to be, as repressive as he turned out to be?
I think Ayatollah Khomeini duped a lot of people. When he was in Paris, he talked about creating an Islamic democracy, a democratic Islamic republic. As soon as he got back to Tehran, he said, "Don't use the word democratic. There's no place for it." But not only were foreign journalists duped, Iranian revolutionaries were duped as well. And you see what's playing out now is really the unfinished business of the early revolution. I mean, right now, some of the most diehard reformers were some of the most diehard revolutionaries. And they're saying, "Hey, you know what? Our revolution got hijacked. We fought to overthrow the Shah to create a democratic society, not one that where a supreme leader, where one man has too much power."
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, this has really been fun, and thank you very, very much.
Elaine Cialino is a senior writer at the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. Her new book is called Persian Mirrors, The Elusive Face of Iran. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Books Division, publisher of Sometimes I Dream in Italian by Rita Cerisi, a new novel by the author of Pink Slip. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how baseball fans followed the World Series in the days before radio. We talk with baseball historian Jules Tigel, and Maureen Carrigan reviews the complete short stories of Evelyn Waugh. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Back of throws. There's a long shot. It's going to be, I believe. The Giants run the pellet. 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 Bobby Thompson hits into the bag net of the left field stand. The Giants run the pellet. And they're going crazy. They're going crazy.
That's Russ Hodges announcing what may be the most famous home run in baseball history. Bobby Thompson's homer was the final play that led to the defeat of the Brooklyn Dodgers in the playoffs and sent the New York Giants to face the Yankees in the Subway Series of 1951. A Subway Series wasn't quite as surprising then as it is today. There were only 16 major league teams, and four of them were in New York. Tonight is game four of the current Subway Series, with the Yankees ahead of the Mets by one game. My guest is baseball historian Jules Tigel. He's the author of a book about Jackie Robinson. His latest book is called Pastime, Baseball as History. He lives in San Francisco, but he grew up in New York and remembers the Subway Series of 1956. I asked him to take us back to the early days of baseball, when the World Series first became popular.
It catches on quite early. The first series is in 1903. Certainly by about 1910, this has become a major feature on the public landscape. And in those days, the way that most people received their information, because this was before radio, is that each town and each city would set up large scoreboards in which crowds of people, hundreds of people, sometimes thousands of people, sometimes in the big cities, tens of thousands of people would gather to watch the game. And what they were watching was a recreation, where on either side of the score, you had a diamond in the middle. On either side of the scoreboard, you had the lineups from one team or the other team. If somebody got a hit, you would see the runner move to first base. They would keep track of balls and strikes. And people really, for people who lived thousands of miles away or hundreds of miles away and had no way of really seeing a baseball game, this was a moment of high drama. And this remained the way most Americans watched the World Series and received the World Series until the 1920s, when radio came into being.
So in the telegraph era, there were actual theatrical reenactments of the game through the telegraph messages that were conveyed about the game as it happened.
That's right. In some theaters, they actually did have people who ran the bases for you, but other... They had these very complex magnetic scoreboards where you can sometimes see the players coming to the plate or see the runners running around the base. But the usual thing was much more a usual recreation, was a very simple, basic recreation of the lineups, the action. And people really would stand there just waiting with bated breath to see what would happen next. And the telegraph allowed them to know instantaneously, as it was happening at the stadium, what was happening wherever they were. And to most people, this was a miraculous experience, to actually be at an event that was taking place thousands of miles away.
Have you read any of the telegraph messages from early baseball? Mm. And is there anything you could tell us about what the language was like before we had, you know, baseball announcers and color casters?
The language on the telegrams, I haven't read them, but I know they were very strictly factual. And in fact, the telegraph operator really prided himself on not putting any of himself into it. He was not a fan. He was not trying to embellish the game reports. He was just trying to get the facts straight so that people could receive those facts quickly and accurately. And that's one of the great changes that occurs in the 1920s with radio. When they first began to experiment with radio, for example, in the 1922 World Series, when they hired Grantland Rice to broadcast the game. And Rice really had no idea what to do. He really didn't know what a radio announcer should do, and he was like the telegraph operator. The next year, Graham McNamee, who was a trained opera singer and had just gotten into radio announcing, became the announcer for the World Series. But McNamee, who was an entertainer, who was a performer, understood that on the radio, people wanted to hear description. They wanted to hear more than the facts. They wanted to be caught up into the excitement of the game. They wanted to hear the sound of the crowd. And this is something that he was able to convey just instinctively. He realized that this is what you needed on radio. And in essence, he was inventing modern broadcasting, modern sportscasting, which hadn't existed just a few years earlier.
What can you tell us about the first World Series broadcast on radio in 1922?
It was very tinny. They had very poor lines. It was very dull in many ways, because Rice really was not a very good announcer. On the other hand, people who listened to it thought it was the most exciting thing that they ever heard. I think to capture, one of the things I try to do in my book is to capture different moments when the game changes for people, game changes for the fans. And that's one of the key moments, the notion that fans could actually be in the ballpark, hear what is going on. There's this vicarious sensation of being at the scene, of being part of something. And I think it's hard for us to imagine the excitement that radio generated in the 1920s, the true miracle of radio, that these people were coming into your home and were telling you, were sharing the game with you, and were recreating that experience. Radio in the 1920s was really a groundbreaking technology, and baseball was one of the main vehicles. It was one of the main things that people enjoyed, particularly that World Series. People waited every year for McNamee to come on and deliver the World Series, and they gathered around their radios much in the way we might gather around our televisions, or they would put radio speakers up in the streets and people would gather in groups to enjoy the game. It was a revolutionary undertaking, and baseball really was in the forefront of that radio revolution.
When was the World Series first broadcast on TV?
I believe it was 1947, very quickly after World War II, but it was only broadcast in the New York area. I think it was very fortunate for television that all of those World Series from 47 to 56 were in New York, were Subway Series, with one exception, because in the early days of television, television existed primarily in the big cities. And, for example, out in the West Coast or in a place like Denver, they had no way of broadcasting or telecasting live events up until 1951. So the primary audience in for the World Series on television was originally in New York, then in the East Coast. So it was quite a good coincidence for early TV that all of those games were played in New York.
What are some of the ways you think that television has changed baseball?
Well, I think, you know, in many ways it's democratized it. It enables us to see far more games. I mean, when people talk about the golden age of baseball in the 1920s, most people never got to see a Major League Baseball game. Most people didn't get to see these Major League players. They began to see them in newsreels in the theaters, which was another major breakthrough at that time. But they never really saw them in person, except maybe in the postseason, players would barnstorm around the nation. Babe Ruth would take an all-star team, and that was a very popular attraction. But, of course, with television, we all can see games. We all can see more games than we ever dreamed of seeing, and probably more games than it's good for us to see in the course of a season. And so I think one of the key contributions is to democratize the game.
Let's go back to very early baseball history, to 1860, when there was a Currier and Ives illustration that had the caption, "The National Game." Describe this illustration for us.
It's a wonderful illustration. It's an illustration about what was, at that time, the most important presidential election in the nation's history, and that was the election where Lincoln came to office. And it shows the four presidential candidates of the time and all of their respective positions, but they're all dressed as baseball players. And Lincoln is for non-extension of slavery, and he's carrying a big, actually not a bat, but a rail, because he was the rail splitter. And Stephen Douglas is there advocating his position. And they're all talking as if this was not a political election, but a baseball game. They talk about being struck out and hitting a home run. And what's striking to me about this cartoon, and I use this to really start to start pastime, is that here we are in 1860, just really a few years after baseball begins to spread in popularity. It really is in 1855 that the game begins to take off, and it's primarily at that time a New York game. And yet Currier and Ives, which has a national clientele, is very confident that people will understand the baseball imagery, and they also are using the term that's increasingly used to describe baseball, the national game, and of course it's also being called the national pastime at that time. So the puzzle is, why did baseball appeal to the people of that era? Here is where baseball suddenly is becoming an integral part of American culture, of American society. And that cartoon, I think, captured that that puzzle.
Well, what was baseball like in 1860 at the time of this illustration?
Well, it was not a professional game, although we do have at that time some of the clubs that are organizing the game, clubs like the Knickerbocker Club or the Excelsiors of Brooklyn. Some of these clubs are beginning to sort of pay people under the table or hire people in a certain job, but their real job is to play baseball. So professionalization is creeping in. And many of the rules are the same that we have today. Certainly, you play for balls and strikes, although the numbers of balls and strikes varied from place to place. They played a nine-inning structure, which was different than earlier versions, where you might play the first team to get 100 runs. They played games that the pitching was underhand, and the batters could tell a pitcher if they wanted a high pitch or a low pitch or a pitch in the middle. So the game was still evolving, but it's a game that I think we would still recognize in most of its respects.
You credit Henry Chadwick as being, you know, one of the men who actually created modern baseball. And it was during this era that we're talking about in the mid-1800s. You say his goal was to create a national game, so he needed uniform rules, scoring. What are some of the things that he invented?
Well, he invents the box score, which, of course, is integral for our understanding the game. He popularizes the batting average, which is not necessarily a good thing because it's not the best measure of hitting prowess, but Chadwick thought it was, and many people still think that it is. What Chadwick really did, Chadwick was not a player, although he was a good athlete himself, but he was a sports writer. And he recognized that this game was something that Americans could like and would like, but that what we needed was some sort of a uniform scoring structure. We needed a statistical basis for comparison. How can you tell, really, just by watching a game, who was a good player, who was not a good player? You might see somebody hit a home run in one game and think he's terrific, but it turns out that it's the only home run he hit. And so Chadwick emphasized record-keeping, score-keeping, developing ways to measure player productivity. He developed the concept of earned runs and unearned runs, which he saw as a batting statistic. He didn't want players to get credit for doing something good when the real contribution was on the negative defense side. So he believed in something really being accounted in a very highly moral. He lived in a very highly moral universe, very structured by pre-Civil War reform movements. And so he integrated all of this into baseball's statistical universe. And many of the statistics, many of the measures that he developed are still the ones that we use to keep track of players today.
My guest is Jules Tigel. He's the author of Pastime, Baseball as History. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jules Tigel, who has written several books about baseball history. His latest is called Pastime, Baseball as History. You see the 1980s as the start of baseball nostalgia. Do you think we're still in that phase of baseball nostalgia?
To a lesser extent, but I think what of course happened in the 1980s is my generation, the baby boom generation, came of age. And this is, I do believe, this may be the last great baseball generation, in that we were raised at a time when baseball was the central sport in America, where America really saw itself coming of age in baseball. We lived through the Jackie Robinson experience, which was such a formative experience for us as a nation, for us as people. And so baseball really means something to my generation. And as we became old, and there were a lot of us, too, that's the other thing. You know, part of the reason baseball has its popularity is among people, I think, age 45 and over, more so than among a younger generation. And, of course, as we've come of age, there are a lot of us. We have a good amount of money in an affluent society, and we're able to indulge our baseball fantasies. And in the 1980s, we indulged them through rotisserie leagues where we sort of managed our own teams, fantasy camps, in which you could go and play with the heroes of your youth. Academics like myself were writing books about baseball, taking it seriously as a scholarly endeavor. The great baseball movies of the 1980s, like Bull Durham and Field of Dreams. I think much of this was a generational thing. And, you know, that generation is still there. And so we still have that sense of nostalgia. But I think it's not quite as heated. It's cooled off a bit in the 1990s and in the 21st century from the way that it was in the 1980s.
The Yankees have won two consecutive World Series. If they win this year, it'll be their third. Some people downplay the achievements of the Yankees, saying that, you know, George Steinbrenner has deep pockets. He just goes out and buys the best players. So, of course, they have a good team. What do you think of that?
I think you still have to make the right decisions. Very clearly, there is an economic imbalance in baseball. I'm not sure it's any different than it always has been, because don't forget, in the golden age of baseball that people want to harken back to, the Yankees won the pennant almost every year. And one of the main reasons for that is they had the money to buy the best players, to scout the best players, to have an extensive developmental farm system. So there was an imbalance historically in baseball. The imbalance that's taking place in the 90s may be a momentary thing. After all, this year in the playoffs, you had low payroll teams like Oakland, like Chicago White Sox, like Seattle, who made it into the playoffs. That's true that two of the higher payroll teams have made it to the World Series. But even when you have a high payroll, you can look at a team like the Baltimore Orioles, like the Los Angeles Dodgers, who seem to make all the wrong decisions. So even when you have a lot of money, you have to have good management. You have to choose the right players. You have to nurture those players and make sure they perform on the field. So I think this remains a tremendous achievement to have won three World Series in 4 years. And certainly if they win another one, they can rank there among baseball's great dynasties.
Well, what are some of your memories of the Subway Series in New York when you were a kid?
I really remember that, you know, there's this notion that people talking about that you could walk through the streets and virtually hear every inning. That's sort of my recollection, too. Everybody seemed to be listening on the radio to the games if they were not inside watching them on television. I think that we sort of saw it as a right. I mean, this was not something that was a surprise, that the way it is now, that comes once every four decades. We had it every year, and we expected it every year. At least one team from New York area would be in the World Series. And, of course, in many years, several teams, or both of the teams in the World Series, would be there. So it seemed, you know, I was 7 years old in 1956, and I was already a very big baseball fan and already going to baseball games, though not the World Series, and it just seemed something like I expected to happen, and I could have never envisioned that within a couple of years, not only wouldn't there be a Subway Series, but there would only be the Dodgers, the Giants would have fled to California, and that era really had come to an end.
You wrote a book about Jackie Robinson, and in writing about Robinson, you wrote about race and baseball. How do you see race as coming into play now in the game?
There's a much more complex racial configuration of the game, because we now have so many more Latino players coming from such a wide range of countries in the Caribbean. And many teams can have players from 5, 6, 7 countries in the Western Hemisphere that have to mix and come together. And, of course, there's also been an influx now of Asian players, particularly Japanese, but also Korean players, and then players from Australia. In many ways, this is a much more international game. And I think that like American society, again, this is reflective of the fact that we used to think of race in terms of black and white. But we live in a much more multicultural society. Baseball is a much more multicultural game. And I think this has added to the allure of baseball. I think certainly the quality of the players being able to tap into that richer international pool has improved the game. But it also, in many ways, like that, when Jackie Robinson, of course, made people think about race relations, I think the international nature of the game makes people think more about the nature of the multicultural society we live in. So once again, baseball has the potential to be a humanizing, to be a democratizing force in American life.
Jules Tigel is the author of Pastime, Baseball as History. He's a professor of history at San Francisco State University. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the complete short stories of Evelyn Waugh. This is Fresh Air. Evelyn Waugh has been hailed as the greatest satirical writer of the 20th century. He died in 1966. Everyman's Library has just brought out an edition of the complete short stories of Evelyn Waugh, and book critic Maureen Corrigan says that this massive dose of Waugh has her wishing for more.
I haven't read Evelyn Waugh for years. A mistake, I admit. Waugh's take on human nature is so acid, so bracing, that his great comic novels like A Handful of Dust, Vile Bodies, Brideshead Revisited, and Love Among the Ruins should be read and reread every few years, just as a tonic for the intellect. I picked up the new Everyman's Library edition of Waugh's complete short stories because I thought his wit would provide just the right literary inoculation against the stammering and yammering of the recent presidential debates. I also thought it would be fun to lose myself in Waugh's world of the 1920s and 30s, a twilight of the British Empire place, awash in pink gin and populated by bright young things and dozing Colonel Mustards. What I'd forgotten about Waugh and what the short stories vividly reminded me of was his taste for the grotesque, even the grisly. He's not only the perfect writer to read for relief from political cant, he's also seasonably suitable for Halloween. His stories are filled with lunatics, severed limbs, crumbling ancestral mansions, the wicked and the damned, all rendered with Waugh's inimitable light touch. The Everyman's edition unearths 38 stories in all, lots of wonderful, long-out-of-print pieces, as well as some of Waugh's juvenilia and satirical cartoons. There are also two chapters here of an unfinished novel, which goes by the title Work Suspended, that Waugh began in the fateful month of September 1939. In a letter to Alexander Wolcott, dated summer 1942, Waugh explains why he abandoned the book. "It is now clear to me that even if I were again to have the leisure and will to finish it, the work would be in vain, for the world in which and for which it was designed has ceased to exist." That novel fragment is almost as hard to read as Waugh's giggly juvenilia, but for a far different reason. It's so atmospheric, so rich with character and plot possibilities, that you just wish Waugh, in this instance, had had less artistic integrity. The narrator, John Plant, is a detective fiction writer who's in Fez, Morocco, writing in a cheap hotel whose clientele consists of elderly couples of small means withering in the sun. Plant receives word that his father, an artist and a forger, has just died and left him the dismal family pile. So he returns to England, falls in love with a married woman, and that's about all Waugh wrote. Blast him. To get a sense of what was lost to the treasure house of satire when Waugh abandoned this novel, just listen to this bit of conversation between Plant and his publisher. Plant feels he's turning into a hack, and he's announced that he wants to try something new in his writing. "You've not been writing any poetry in Morocco," says the publisher. "No, no. Sooner or later, almost all my novelists come into me and say they've written poetry. I can't think why. It does them infinite harm. Only last week, Roger Simons was here with a kind of a play. You never saw such a thing. All the characters were parts of a motor car, magneto and sparking plugs and camshaft, all talking in verse about communism. Alas, we can assume there would have been plenty of O. Henry-ish plot twists in the novel, because Wall loved that kind of thing. Many of the best short stories here end with wallops, whose effect I won't ruin by revealing. Instead, there's plenty else to enthuse about in Waugh's writing. His language is like some smoothed, aged whiskey laced with delayed reaction poison. It takes a few seconds before you feel its lethal intent. The short story, Incident in Azania, for instance, takes place in colonial Africa and features an eligible young woman named Prunella Brooks, whom Waugh slyly describes as an iridescent blonde with a fresh skin, with rubbery, puppyish limbs, and a face which lit up with amusement at the most barren pleasantries. The Man Who Loved Dickens is a short story that Wall wrote in 1933 that became the germ of his masterpiece, A Handful of Dust. Reading this earlier incarnation of that novel's famous ending, it seemed to me the most awful aspect of Paul Henty's fate is certainly not that he's forced to read Dickens aloud for the rest of his life, or even that he's being held captive in the jungle. No, it's that Henty is doomed to reading Dickens aloud to a menacing audience of one, Mr. McMaster, who doesn't really get Dickens. Waugh notes how McMaster often asks the wrong questions and laughs at the wrong passages. Surely this is the writer's nightmare, that the reader just won't understand the story. It's a nightmare that Waugh, as so many of these brilliantly absurd, eccentric, and touching stories confirmed, worked very hard to exorcise.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the complete short stories of Evelyn Waugh. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the breakdown of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process with two people who negotiated the 1993 peace agreement, Palestinian Hanan Ashrawi and Israeli Uri Sevier. And we talk with two journalists, one Palestinian and one Israeli. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.